Blog Talk Radio.
All right, we are on the air, V-Spot, Sunday night, August 4th. I'm going to be talking to Dylan Waco of Internet Wrestling fame. How are you doing, Dylan?
Dylan's not here yet.
Oh, okay. That's okay, that's actually Dill. Lousy Neil. How are you doing, Neil?
I just got finished watching that episode of Beetlejuice that I remember from years back.
Which one was it?
The Cabin Fever one.
Okay. Yeah, so anyway, oh, here he is. Now we have Dylan Hill, Dylan Waco of Internet Wrestling fame. How are you doing, Dylan?
Hey, I'm doing good. How are you, Vic?
I'm pretty good. I woke up at like 8 o'clock, so I still came within 2 hours of oversleeping.
My wife and child have been out of town, so my sleep schedule has been completely absurd for like the last week and a half. I just sleep whenever I feel like it, wake up whenever I feel like it.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing. I think I took some nerve pills last week, and I have no tolerance to them. So they pretty much just knocked me for a loop.
Well, yeah, I can't take anything.
You know, they take them until their tolerance is built up, when in reality, when they see they're building a tolerance, they should just cut it out.
Yes.
But then again, I guess you're a drug addict.
I have no tolerance to anything because I don't even drink. So if you give me a half a hydrocodone, it's like mainlining China white heroin. I'm completely done. You know, like I said.
Yeah, that's how I am. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't even drink coffee. So a nerve pill, it's pretty much just taking me into a dream world. Of course, I feel kind of weird when I take a pill or something, because some people become mean. I just say things matter-of-factly, like Neil, my co-host right now, like he'll come and say something to me, and if he's bugging me, I'll just be like, Neil, shut the fuck up. And I'll say it in the nicest, polite way.
See, the last time I took any kind of like sleep and or pain medication was probably a few Thanksgivings ago because I had a tooth removed. And it was 10,000 times worse than if I just let the abscess stay in my head, because I was projectile vomiting and like screaming curse words at my brothers and family members when they came to see if I was alive or dead. Like, it would have been way better off if I had just fought through the hell that was, you know, my abscess tooth and dealt with it on my own terms. But I guess if you don't pull an abscess, you kind of die anyway. So I didn't really have a choice.
If it makes you feel any better, we have all the projectile vomiting and cursing at my Thanksgiving without drugs.
to be fair, when we were kids, I'm the oldest of four boys, and when we were kids, this is how horrible we are. I probably shouldn't be saying this on air, but I don't really care. We used to have a contest on Thanksgiving to see who could make my mother cry first. That's how bad we were as children. So, Thanksgiving in our house was and still is always pretty interesting.
Well, Neil gets a serious illness before holidays because they have to drive up to Nashville. And every year now, and I finally caught on to it, it's like a day before Christmas and Thanksgiving, Neil will go around going, I'm sick. And he actually is sick. Somehow Neil controls his body enough to force himself to be sick.
You know what, if you can do that, you're doing pretty good. I wish I could control mine, I can't.
It's just Neil has a weird ethical, Neil's a coward, but he also has an ethical dedication to the truth. Like, basically, if you told him to give you his last $50, he'd do it, but if you told him to admit Mega Man 2 was clearly better than Mega Man 3, he'll fight you. You would have to stab him.
Now, okay, because I actually like Mega Man 2 better.
It's definitely better. It's definitely better, but Neil will go. The creator of Mega Man said that threw Mega Man 3 under a bus, and Neil still will not admit it.
But you know what? Like, the th- thing about video games is, video games are actually a lot like wrestling, I think. When you have an attachment to a game, all common sense goes out the window. It's like, for me, like, I was never a big PlayStation guy. All my favorite games were, like, basically the original console games. And I like side-scrollers. I don't like hardly any modern games. But to me, like, something like I the one game I really loved that was, you know, sort of a secondary console was Twisted Metal 2. And everybody else was like, that game sucks, or Twisted Metal, the original's better. I'm like, fuck you, it's not. this is not open for debate. It's not open for discussion. And that's kind of how, like, it's the same thing to me with wrestling. Like, there's certain wrestlers where it's like, okay, if you don't like them, that's fine, but don't tell me about it. Just keep that to yourself.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting thing, because I was telling somebody, you know, about Bruiser Brody, and, you know, the online community has really turned on Brody.
Okay.
You know, and I guess for good reason, but the thing is, I love Brody just because I believe in the ideal of Bruiser Brody.
You know what? I kind of get that. Because I've said this before many times in many places about Brody specifically. His look is one of those things that if you just saw him in the magazines, and I know you're a big magazine guy like I am too, and
yeah,
especially like I was growing up, Vic, but if you just saw him in the magazines, he looked like the coolest guy ever. I mean, like, he looked like a guy that, I mean, he really looked like a terrifying, psychotic, wild madman, you know? I mean, he completely looked the part. And to me, that's actually part of the reason he was so disappointing, even as a kid, because I expected him to come to the ring and just wreak havoc and destroy everything. And then once he got in the ring, he was never, like, his entrance was always the peak. And then that's when it was kind of downhill. But I do sort of get the idea. And there's a lot of wrestlers like that. I always point, and I know this is, I'm going to sound like I'm pandering to the host here, but another guy, like there's guys like Sabu and Abdul the Butcher. There's something about just their aura that there's no way I could call them a bad wrestler ever. Like, even if I didn't think they were good in the ring, and I actually like both guys in the ring, but even if I didn't think they were good in the ring, just the aura and the way they project themselves, it makes it impossible for me to call them bad, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And Sabu's the only wrestler I can watch him in. I'd rather watch Sabu in a bad match than a lot of guys in good matches, because, like, I saw this Necro Butcher match that he had, and Sabu and Necro Butcher, it was so disappointing because they had no chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know what that's about.
And that's one of those, so, you know what, though? That's also one of those things where it's like, sometimes things are almost too good to be true. You know, that's why I was really happy when the Necro Butcher New Jack match from earlier this year actually turned out to be really good. Because on paper it seemed like kind of cool, but it also seemed like something that could be a complete disaster. And it actually turned out to be a really good, I mean, for that kind of match, which is not everybody's thing, and I understand that, but for that kind of match, it was awfully good. But, you know, Sabu, you know, when I was going through and when we were doing the ECW set for, you know, the project we did on that, Sabu was like one of these guys where it didn't matter if he was wrestling like the One Man Gang or Billy Black or somebody completely random. You always kind of got excited for his matches. And maybe it didn't live up to the hype, but I kind of really didn't care. Like, I'd be like, oh, this is random as hell. Sabu versus Billy Black? How can I not get excited to watch this? You know what I mean?
Well, he's one of those guys, really, in a way. And I mean, like, you can't put it on a large scale, but in the ECW scale, Sabu was a lot like a Hulk Hogan in a way. He was the main event himself. You could put him against almost anybody on the roster or even outsiders, and the fans are going to think, hey, hell yeah, it's Sabu.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. I think he was like the only guy, well, he was the only guy in the early part of ECW, you know, for the first couple of years that was like that. I think as time went on, there was maybe a few other guys like that too, but he's definitely the guy, like, to this day, he's probably the first guy I think of when I think of ECW. You know, he's not my favorite guy from ECW. That's where me and you probably differ, but he's definitely the first guy I think of.
I mean, I think eventually Rob Van Dam was able to do that to a degree on television, not so much at house shows. But on television,
yeah,
you know, he could at least make his matches an event, but you couldn't put him against just anybody on a house show and have it matter.
No. Van Dam, you know, you and I have talked about this before, you know, privately. To me, Van Dam is such a weird wrestler because my favorite Van Dam is the Van Dam that takes crazy bumps, you know, and does all, like, that kind of stuff. like there's a really good fan cam with him and Chris Jericho from 96 where he takes like three or four psychotic bumps, and it's not even that well attended a show. But the Van Dam that most people really remember and love is, you know, the Mr. Monday Night era and past that. And while there's some of that stuff that I like, man, and I've made this analogy before, but, like, he really is almost – he's doing, like, a carrot top routine, you know? Like, Fonzie's there with his props. And
he's just running through. I love that.
I think at the time, I think everybody loved it. You know, because it was different. It was new. But looking back, it was real, real tough because I watched so much ECW. I'm probably one of the few people on the planet that's watched more ECW than you. And I watched so much ECW that after a while, I was like, God. You know, on the other hand, when he had a good match like that, like he had a match I really liked was he had a match with Kamala 2, or Uganda, as he wrestled in ECW.
Yeah.
He gave him a lot of that match, and they went like 17 or 18 minutes, which on paper is completely absurd. But it actually really worked. You know, the other guys that were involved didn't like it as much as me, which is why it didn't end up seeing the light of day. But if I were to ever do like sort of like a cutting room floor sort of DVD project or something like that for matches, that would probably be one of them because I really enjoyed that.
Did you see the match at the ECW Arena they had? And the thing is with RVD, him and Sabu had the best promos together. Because he would be such a condescending.
I do think there was something really cool about that act when they were together.
And he's getting ready to take on Uganda or Botswana Beast, Kamala too. Anyway, he's like this, and he said, "And I want to say get well to my partner Sabu and the Sheik's second favorite wrestler." And Sabu's on crutches, and like he's having to have like 10 people hold him back.
Now you know what? I'm gonna ask. Can I throw something at you, Vic? Because there's something that came up. I was having a discussion with another wrestling buddy of mine about 1997 and that crazy angle where Lawler came into the arena and then Jim Cornette, and they, you know, it was the beginning of the WWF ECW stuff. And this sort of just popped in my head, and I want to know if you think it would work, because you're an ECW connoisseur like I am. How do you think it would have been? Because I think this would have been really awesome. What if the lights had gone out and they'd come back on, and Lawler was in the ring and Terry Funk was there, and you think they're going to rekindle their old rivalry, and then Funk turns heel on ECW?
Well, that would have been great. And the thing with Terry Funk is, Terry Funk is so crazy that anything he does, you kind of make it work because it's like, if you go back to when he turned heel on Tommy Dreamer, which was, that worked so well because it was like the drunken dad turning on you. You know, and I remember, you know, there was a man that was killed by a hippo a year ago. He had a pet hippo and he killed him. And, you know, JBL said the hippo didn't go crazy, it just went hippo. And that's what Terry Funk does. He does go crazy. He just goes Terry Funk.
That's a very good way of putting it. That popped into my head the other night. And I, you know, I'm usually not a big fantasy booking guy. I don't oppose it, really. It's just not something I spend a lot of time doing, per se.
Well, it's kind of exercise frustration.
It just entered my head, and I was like, holy crap. That would have been, like, the craziest mindfuck and most awesome. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think Terry Funk in 97 ECW was awesome anyway, just the babyface stuff.
Yeah.
That would have been, like, the most unbelievable thing ever in a whole feud that was really unbelievable in hindsight. You know, and at the time, it was unbelievable if you're watching. It was completely crazy.
Yeah, it really was. It was like, in a summer of strong angles all around in every promotion, I'm pretty sure even Japan was having a strong year.
Yes.
I still think ECW, like, angle-wise, was the best of all the promotions, and I honestly feel like that summer ended up burning out Paul Heyman creatively.
You know what? I actually can't really argue against that, because I think 98, a lot of people criticized them in 99 and 2000 creatively. I actually think their low point creatively might have been 98. 97 was a really strong year for them creatively, really from the top of the card to the bottom. I mean, they had a lot of good stuff going on and a lot of really interesting stuff going on that was outside of, I mean, I always, to me, I look at, like, all that stuff, like that segment with Lawler especially. Heyman did Crash TV the right way. You know, Russo,
yeah.
Russo watched Heyman and learned all the wrong lessons. You know what I mean? Like, it's like Russo looked at him and was like, oh, we're just going to throw a bunch of shit and segments back to back to back and it's all going to work, blah, blah, blah. But that, but he left out all the stuff and interesting stuff that made ECW actually work.
Yeah, you know, the thing I really liked about that year was, and they got it so right, was is that you actually did kind of have a lot of shades of gray because there were so many different heel factions and they didn't like each other. And
yeah.
My favorite thing was that the arena during the Lawler angle was, Fonzie gets on microphone, he said, hey, franchise, why don't you come down here and get some of this? And Shane Douglas said, I don't give a shit, I'm just an amused observer.
That is actually one of the most underrated parts of that whole angle is when Fonzie calls him out, because it was the perfect response from Douglas, you know, and
yeah.
that was such a weird year for Shane in a lot of ways too, because of the injury and because of the promotion was clearly changing in ways that probably should have been beneficial to him, but they didn't end up being, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, the thing about it is, I know that Shane actually didn't want anything to do with the WWF angle. Like, he was against even bringing them in. And he said that he told him beforehand, he told Lawler, he said, don't bring up my name, don't talk about me. He said, because I swear to God, I'll beat the fuck out of you.
Well, I know for a fact that Shane probably, I mean, because he just left, what, the year before, I guess, right?
He had no interest.
Yeah, and I'm sure he didn't want to be sucked back into that, because you talk about a guy whose WWF experience was less than ideal. I think Dean Douglas would be one of the all-time less than ideal. I mean, if you really think about it, that's an unbelievably poor use of Shane Douglas from that time period.
It's interesting when I heard Shawn Michaels, you know, talking a shoot interview about Shane, and this is like back in 98, he was actually pretty even-handed about it. You know, which compared to his book, you know, in the book he just buries them. But in 98, he's talking about it, and I'll take the 98 version probably because it seemed like he was probably closer to it then.
Yeah.
But he was actually really fair about it, and the only thing he said about, you know, Michaels actually made sense. He said Scott Hall would not have sandbagged Shane because he said it would have made him look bad. You know, and he said that
yeah.
He didn't think that he...
To me, Hall was always a guy where if he didn't want to work with somebody, he usually just didn't work with him. He usually pulled a power play and got around it, or he screwed him on a finish, historically. You know, I mean, he definitely did that in the AWA to Rose and Summers. But he also, I never thought Scott Hall was the kind of guy who would sandbag somebody in the ring, which is slightly different.
Especially
you know,
on
like,
television.
Yeah, I mean, that really doesn't help... That really doesn't help you at all. Then again, you know, who knows how bad off Hall was with his drug problems at that point. I mean, that was probably on the front end of his absolute worst period, I guess. But who knows how bad off he was? I don't think – because, I mean, you can never really account for what a junkie is going to do, you know? I mean, you never really can. I say that to somebody who has way too much experience with people who have substance abuse problems.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
You never really can. Even good people will do unbelievably dumb shit when they're heavily under the influence. So, on one hand, I kind of agree with you. On the other hand, you never know.
Well, you know, the match they had on pay-per-view at the October pay-per-view for the Intercontinental title, I didn't think that was really a bad match. I mean, it wasn't as good as you would think a Shane Douglas-Scott Hall match would have been at the time. But I watched it,
My memory was that it was pretty decent, but that's something I haven't... That's a period of WWF I probably need to go back and watch again at some point. I'd have to get motivated for it. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I ordered the pay-per-view live, so mind you, my memory might be different because I'm really determined that every pay-per-view I watched was good because, you know, it cost so much money.
See, this is an interesting topic because one of the great joys of my life was that at the time my best friend and the guy, you know, he had a black box, so I didn't pay for any pay. I watched every pay-per-view live, and didn't pay for a single one of them from Bash of the Beach 94 basically until about 2005.
Well, you know, one of the best things, luckiest breaks I ever had was when I got Starrcade 96 for free. And again, I didn't do anything to do it. I used to, as a kid, I used to turn to the pay-per-view channel, or a teenager.
Oh, yeah.
I would turn to the pay-per-view, and I would watch the first 2 minutes of the pay-per-view before it got scrambled. But in this case, it never scrambled. And then eventually, I decided, hey, I'm getting the whole show. I'm going to tape this. And at one point, my mother was going to try to turn the channels, and I just kind of went,
When I was a kid, you know, for Hogan Warrior, that was a huge deal as a kid. And by that point, I had already soured some on Hogan. I mean, I was still a fan to the degree that most kids were, but he was no longer anywhere close. I mean, he was nowhere near my favorite guy at that point, but he still, to me, stood for the WWF. And I did not like Warrior even then at all. And I was adamant that Hogan had to win. And I remember watching that scramble. And, I mean, I was basically listening to it scramble, because at the time you could hear it, but you really couldn't see much when it was scrambled. But I remember just sitting there listening to it. And I remember as they were calling the match, and when I realized that Warrior was going to win, I remember getting up and just taking the pillow that was on my parents' bed and just heaving it across the room and knocking a bunch of crap on the floor because I was so pissed off.
Well, I didn't like Warrior as a kid. Well, I liked him beforehand, but I eventually in the schoolyard there was becoming this very heavy divide between Hogan fans and Warrior fans. And you know, Hulk Hogan for me as a little kid, you know, that was probably as religious as I was. You know, because when I was a kid and I saw him in person, and I'm not kidding you about this. This is the closest thing I ever had to a religious experience. You know, when he beat up Boss Man and Akeem at that Huntsville taping, man, it was like, that's close to I ever come to God coming down and visiting me.
How often do you get to go to live shows as a kid, Vic?
That was the only one. I went then, and I wanted to go to the NWA months later, but, you know, I don't know why I didn't ask. I was a weird kid. I just wouldn't ask for things. You know, and maybe it's because we were poor or something, but I missed an NWA show in Huntsville that had a Terry Funk versus Ric Flair in a Texas Death Match.
Oh. See, I was very fortunate because my best friend's father was worked for a private security company that did a bunch of different towns in and around, not in and around Charleston, but Charleston, Savannah, Columbia, Florence, Sumter. They did all the WCW shows basically within 100 miles of where I live. So I went to all kinds of wrestling for free. I didn't pay, you know, which is good because we didn't have any money. If it had cost anything, I wouldn't have been going. But I got to see so much stuff. And I had forgotten all about this show. This will probably interest you. In the summer of 89, I saw a show outside of the Citadel's football stadium, Johnson Hagen Stadium. On the card, the main event was Steamboat and Luger, I remember being very good even now, years later. But the two matches that really stood out to me were Eddie Gilbert and Muda and Terry Funk and Sting, which went to an ODQ, and then Muda and Gilbert ran out. There was a crazy brawl, like, all over the football field. I had totally forgotten about that show, and it came up, I forget, it came up in that thread at Death Valley Driver Board, like the best live matches you'd seen or whatever. And I had been talking to somebody just a couple weeks prior about this show, and I was like, man, all of these memories just came flooding back to me of how crazy that show was. God. That was like,
I really liked
that was such a great period for wrestling.
I liked the Eddie Gilbert Muda feud, and I feel bad because every time Muda hit Missy Hyatt with the Miz, I found it hilarious recently. And I feel like a bastard, but I crack up laughing because she's on the ground screaming in pain, and I know that's not right, but I tell myself logically, you know, it's just Miss, you know, it doesn't hurt. But the way he just did it, because she's bouncing off to him, and Moon all of a sudden just missed her. And he was just doing it at random to her. Like, he was kind of sneaking up on her in the way Moon would sneak up on anybody. Then Eddie Gilbert came out later, and he tried to throw a fireball at him and ended up hitting some jobber.
Yes, yes. That TV was really, really entertaining. But, you know, I think I mentioned this to you the other day. Muta here in South Carolina was almost a babyface. Like, I mean, he really wasn't quite a babyface because people still weren't going to cheer him over the Horsemen, especially during the JTX Horsemen feud.
You wish you could cheer him.
But people really, I think, he was so flashy and so different that he really appealed to a lot of people. He would get chants at the McAllister Fieldhouse, you know.
Yeah.
And Charleston was a heel town to the degree that Flair was really popular. But in hindsight, that's really weird because Muta's the only guy, aside from the Horseman, that ever got a reaction like that when I was a kid.
Well, he's so cool looking, and really, as a kid, I wished I could cheer him. But it was one of those things. I just didn't cheer heels. I remember, you know, like if Dino Bravo became a face, I would have cheered Dino Bravo. And Dino Bravo was like one of the first guys I realized this guy kind of sucks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't put my finger on why.
You know, it's funny you should say that because my daughter's the same way. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I don't know if I've told you this or not, but she a couple years ago during the height of Mark Henry's Hall of Pain run, she actually wrote a letter to WWE corporate headquarters saying that he should be banned forever because he was too strong and too mean. And I had flashbacks to being a kid because that was the kind of stuff I would do when I was her age. You know, like the heels, the scary heels, when they really get going and you're a kid, man, it's totally different than when you're adult.
Well, you know, Mark Henry was around when I was a kid, I'd have been fucking terrified of him. But, you know, I told this to you, you know, but when the Road Warriors turned heel on Sting, that horrified me because I didn't think anybody could stop them because they dismantled Sting. And I remember watching TV because I can still remember watching TV when they put the spike in Dusty Rhodes' eye.
Yep.
And, you know, and I'll be honest with you, I was watching as a kid, I believed everything was 100% real. I mean, you had to convince me because, you know, I want to live in a world where wrestling's real. You know, to me, that's the world I want. And I told somebody the other day, you know, like Brody, I believe in the ideal of wrestling. It's probably about how I believe in God, you know. It's like I'll believe in the ideal enough that it'll make it real.
Yeah,
I
knew wrestling wasn't real or whatever the hell term you want to use from a very young age, but I would go out of my way to convince myself that it was. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I would do anything I could to justify in my mind that all these things everybody, my parents, all these people were telling me was complete crap. And I didn't fully accept, I don't think I really fully accepted that there was no reality to things until I was like 13 years old.
Well, the thing was, when eventually I accepted it, you know, I stopped enjoying wrestling. I could still enjoy it a bit, you know, because it's pretty cool in general, you know, but like during the height of the Monday Night Wars, like in 98, I wasn't really watching. I was watching every week, but I didn't give a fuck. I was in the comics and video games.
It never affected my enjoyment, to be honest, but I can absolutely see how it does for some people.
I don't know if it affected, you know, I'm not sure if it was that affected it, but at that point, I'll tell you what it was. WWF was doing this shit in 98 that I couldn't explain. If I could explain it, you know, that's fine. Because when I was a kid, my mama, she explained Santa Claus to me for a 5-year-old in such an airtight manner. Like, she said that Santa couldn't get the expensive gifts because the parents had to pay a portion of it to help him, and that he would go to Walmart and pick it up and then bring it to our house, and that they left the door unlocked.
That's pretty airtight.
Yeah, that's pretty airtight.
That's a much better job than I did.
Right, so when I watch wrestling, you know, I would explain shit. I still, Neil, are you there?
Yeah.
Neil, I have this habit when Neil will pick out a plot hole in a movie, I'll fill it up immediately. And like Neil said about Mario 2, he said, hey, how'd those enemies appear in Mario 3 if they were in his dream? I said, that's what Mario based the dream on. It just pissed Neil off.
That's awesome.
You know? So as I watch wrestling, you know, the 90s, like, The Undertaker, I can explain a lot of The Undertaker stuff because I just said he's a weird, creepy guy who thinks he's a zombie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, okay. I can almost buy that.
Okay, so we get to Raw in 98 with him and Kane. Him and Kane have a fireworks duel or something, and again, I can't really explain that, but it's so awesome, I'm not going to try. But then, do you remember the episode of Raw when Kane drug out the Undertaker's dead parents of the casket?
No.
Okay, he drug
them
out.
How do I not remember that?
They never showed this again, you know. So, but anyway, Undertaker goes up and fights Kane and chokeslams Kane, or Kane chokeslams Undertaker into the corpse of his dead mother.
Oh, my God.
There's an explosion of dust. And again, this is when people were talking about Katie Vick. I was like, how is that a big deal? That's clearly Triple H humping a dummy. No, but this right here, and I watched this, and I was like, I can't explain this shit.
Well, you know, I actually think the worst, and I admit that I kind of laughed because I laugh at any really dark humor, but I think, like, the bit with Boss Man and the Big Show, and, you know, the stuff where they were feuding around his dead dad or whatever, and they did the thing where Big Show, like, surfed out on the coffin at the funeral, and then Boss Man wrote the epic love poem, which was roses are red, violets are blue. No, wait a minute, how'd it go? It went, roses are red, violets are blue. If I had a son as stupid as me, then I'd pray for cancer so I could die too. I mean, like, it was like the worst thing ever. I still can't believe that was on TV. Like, it blew my mind that they actually allowed that on television. And I'm not a guy who really gets offended very often. I wasn't even necessarily offended. I just couldn't believe it was on television.
Well, they excel in the Big Show DVD, you know. And again, you know, in some cases, I believe, you know, I honestly think a guy at Show stature at this point, if he was bothered by something, I think he'd actually say it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, because, you know, he's got money. He could go anywhere he wanted at the moment, you know. I mean, he'd get a gig in Japan if he decided to leave. He'd just do it immediately. But anyway, he said at the time that they actually had to start making it more comedic with Boss Man, like the casket surfing, because they said Boss Man was getting death threats.
I don't doubt that, because I actually don't doubt that in the least, because I actually did a show earlier today on the AWA with some other guys early this morning, and we were talking about Colonel DeBeers and, like, the promos he would cut there, and the Boss Man promos, particularly that poem, but some of the other stuff in that feud was some of the craziest, like, stuff I'd seen on TV since the DeBeers stuff. Now, the DeBeers stuff was a whole nother level. I mean, the DeBeers stuff was completely insane, especially for the friggin' AWA in 1986. You know, I mean, you got a guy going on TV, like, talking about how the United States is a decadent cesspool of a country, and, you know, not, it's not a wonderful paradise like South Africa where they don't have AIDS. Think about that for a second. On television. No, in fact,
well,
that wasn't
on
TV. That was on ESPN.
I don't know if I mentioned this, but I actually found a narrative to explain why Boss Man went insane in 99. Okay, at WrestleMania 15, which, by the way, that Hell in a Cell match is actually a pretty underrated brawl. And I think a lot of people hate it just because it didn't have some crazy stunt bump.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
Okay, Boss Man nearly died. He was hung. Boss Man's near-death experience drove him insane. So that's why he took a hardcore title feud with Al Snow far beyond what anyone else would do.
He took it to the Mr. Fuji level.
Right, and then when he starts feuding with Big Show, you know, which, again, that's insane to pick a fight with Big Show. But then Big Show gets the world title, and, you know, in my narrative, Boss Man's thinking this is his last chance at ever being a world champion. So he just goes completely Daffy Duck on him. I mean, I can't even explain what Boss Man's doing, but he just became a cartoon supervillain.
there are worse ways you could explain that bizarre turn of events than that. I wouldn't even begin to try to explain it.
I think the problem was with the pay-per-view was it was just another match. They made it like a 5-minute Raw match, and, you know, and sure, Big Show chokeslammed Big Boss Man, but, you know, he drug your father's corpse around. That's not even.
Yeah. Yeah. And
the problem
and,
was...
might even know.
Right, but they say, well, if they made like a bloody arena brawl with all the smoke and mirrors, but the problem was they saved all the blood and shit for Vince McMahon, for Vince and Triple H.
Oh, was that on the same show?
Yeah, and again, in
okay.
that match, though, I'll say this for Triple H, he does want to put somebody over because, you know, he let Vince just beat the shit out of him all over the arena.
Now, you know my thoughts on Triple H, but one thing I
yeah.
was always giving Triple H credit for, you can go back to any old thread or any old podcast or any statement I've ever made about him, one thing that I will always give him credit for is the guy is a great bleeder. He really is. Like,
oh,
I'm not
yeah.
kidding. Like, he's very,
yeah,
he's very at his peak, he knew how to really get the color going, and he knew how to do it in such a way where it felt like a big deal. That is probably actually his single best attribute as a wrestler, in my opinion.
Yeah, I actually enjoy, I've mentioned this before, but I really enjoy that run he had in late 99, more so than 2000, because I feel like, in some ways, I feel like the first Cactus Jack match ruined him, because it became, I don't know, after the Cactus Jack match, everything became this big artistic production for him, and I feel like that he kind of obsessed with recapturing that match.
That's not a bad theory. I could absolutely see that. Because, you know, I mean, I think he definitely always saw himself as a guy who was sort of the heir to your Harley Races and your Ric Flairs, when really he wasn't. I actually think Triple H would have been a much better in-ring performer if he didn't have that opinion of himself.
Yeah, like some of his best stuff that I've liked on TV were just short TV matches.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, some of my favorite Triple H matches are 10 minutes or less.
And if you check out, like, the match he had at Unforgiven, the six-pack challenge, he really held that match together, and that's a really fun, entertaining match because he just gets the shit beat out of him by everybody, and he's really selfless and giving in these matches. Or the match with Austin at No Mercy, which I think was probably their best match just because they really tried to mix it up. Instead of doing the typical nerve, so they had somewhere Austin hit the stunner at 5 minutes in. And Triple
yep.
H got a foot on the rope, just barely got saved. Or at one point they were using the boom mic as a weapon.
Yeah, I mean, like, that period, there was every match, well, I shouldn't say every match, but that period, so many of the main events were kind of your crazy, reckless brawls, like, you know, brawling all over, using weapons. The Spanish announce table, you know, was getting people getting chucked through it. You really had to mix things up to stand out. I mean, you could have a good match without mixing things up, but it wasn't a match anybody was going to remember.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I remember, you know, I'm watching the Mick Foley DVD on Netflix, and Triple H is talking on it, and the weird thing is Shane Douglas was on it earlier, and I swear that Shane and Triple H look like they came from the same cloning vat, but they were messed up. They were both different a little bit.
Let me ask you real quick, Vic. Do you think, and this is kind of a weird person to pick, I guess, but do you think Shane Douglas could have had the run that Triple H had in 99-2000?
Would this have been if he'd been the WWF the entire time?
Yeah.
Yeah, he definitely could have. I mean, I think ECW, he had a lot of great matches there, but I think ECW shortened his career so much, but yeah, I definitely think he could have it. It's unfortunate, you know, which this is going to do. I think the wrestling landscape would have been a lot different, actually, if Shane had stayed at the WWF. But I think if he had stuck around and been patient, he would have gotten a pay-per-view run with Shawn Michaels.
I think that's probably true. I mean, the guy I always point to is the guy who is the big what-if during that time period in the mid to late 90s is Brian Pillman. Because if Brian Pillman doesn't have the drug issues that he has and doesn't get into that car wreck right after he signed with the WWF, I really think he would have been as big a star as Austin or during the Attitude Era. People think that's crazy, and maybe it is, but those two, they were really synonymous with each other in a lot of ways, and Austin obviously was great friends with Pillman and I think intensely loyal to him. And I think they would have been natural rivals. And a part of me wonders if we ever would have seen The Rock the way we saw The Rock if Brian Pillman, if that didn't happen. You know, that's kind of like one of those weird...
The Rock's an interesting guy because there are so many steps where he might not have been a star, because if you look at, you know, like if he had not got a, like let's say, you know, if somehow when he came back from the Nation there wasn't a spot open for him in the Intercontinental title, and really they tried to push Pillman. Pillman's injuries were just too much.
Oh yeah, that's that, I mean he was just done, and that's too bad, because I mean you may know this, a lot of people don't, a lot of people who even know me don't, but Pillman's one of my five favorite wrestlers ever, you know, and I mean he's a guy that I'm still a mark for to this day. There's a lot of guys who I like a lot, but I'm not really a mark for him. Pillman is a guy I'm still a mark for to this day, and I really feel like it's like he was just a little bit ahead of his time, not even much, just like a year too soon with a lot of that stuff. If it had been a year later and the injury doesn't happen, I honestly feel like Ryan Pillman would be like a Hall of Fame level guy, you know. Like, and it's just a shame that didn't happen.
You know, I was thinking about something he did in ECW where he had the all time scummiest ECW moment that no one's ever topped. Shane Douglas is going to punch Pillman, and Pillman holds a baby in front of his face.
The kid, yep. I forgot about that. He does. He holds.
And Shane Douglas, who 6 months later would shake a man by, who would shake a man with a broken neck by a surgically implanted halo. He was taken back by the scumminess. They're about to cut us off in a few minutes, and I wanted to get back to Brody because we were having a conversation last night about it. And, you know, and I didn't get a chance to mention this, Ric Flair in his shoot called Brody, he said Brody was a lot like Hansen or Vader, and that they made you work for whatever you got as offense goes. Okay, and I wonder if the thing with Luger was, because, you know, he probably was fucking with him a bit, but I wonder if a part of it was that Luger was working too light with him, and that he was actually trying to get him to hit him harder.
That is possible. I mean, I don't think it's impossible. People don't know, basically, Brody sandbagged Luger by no-selling all of his offense in a cage match, and Luger just left. I honestly don't know. I think that's within the realm of possibility. I think it's possible that Brody was pulling a power play for somebody else that was pissed off at Luger backstage. I think it's possible that Brody was just being cranky and being Brody, you know? I mean, like, you never really know. Brody was such a weird guy because, in a way, I also admire him, too, because of the fact that he screwed promoters, because promoters screw wrestlers so often. So,
yeah,
like, he gets a lot of shit for that, but in a way, I like that about him.
Yeah, it's best if a promoter's in a conflict with a wrestler, it's best to usually, side with the wrestler. Usually, you know, it's like me and Matt were talking about how Matt said he thought Ultimate Warrior held up Vince. I said, but you got to remember what Vince's definition of held up is. He thinks Jeff Jarrett held him up, you know, and Jarrett wanted money that was already owed.
Well, not only that, but Jarrett wasn't under contract. I mean, it's not Vince's fault that he stupidly booked a pay-per-view match for the guy who wasn't under contract.
Right, and Jarrett didn't hold him up. Jarrett just said, give me money I'm owed. That's it. I want all my money up front so I don't have to come back. He thinks Richter held him up.
Yeah, Vince, and that's how a lot of these wrestling promoters are. They have this idea that they're entitled to effectively, I don't want to use the term slave labor because that's too much, but they have the idea that they're, that's a much better way of putting it. But these guys are indentured service, and they should just do whatever. And that's not how life works, you know? I mean, there are times when wrestlers are in the wrong in these exchanges, but more often than not, my rule is whoever the richer guy is the guy I'm usually going to side against.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty safe rule. I mean, it's not always true, but it's a fairly safe rule. You know,
there are exceptions. There are occasional exceptions to that, but...
Well, I'll tell you, if usually, like, if you see a fight between a really big guy and a really little guy, 9 times out of 10, the really little guy started it.
Yeah, that's true. I agree with that 100%,
and
I am a really little guy.
But, you know, I'm a big fat guy, you know, and I'll tell you, every fight I ever got in school, it would be this, you know, some short kid picking a fight with me, and I don't know why he's doing it, because I have nothing to gain.
Little man syndrome is a bitch.
Yeah. All right, Dylan, we're going to be cut off. Let's try to maybe we can get together again sometime.
Oh, I'd love to do it. Thanks for having me on, Vic. Really appreciate it.
All right. No problem, man. You have a good night. And good night to everybody else listening. We'll try to come back on Tuesday. Good night, everybody.